Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Apples, apple cider, brown sugar, spiced rum. Let's do this.
And what do you think it's going to be?
Something sweet and delicious.
Yeah. This is going to be a granite or a granita, and that means a frozen ice, like an Italian ice, a shaved ice.
Watching Chef Daniel Orr work his magic in the kitchen is always such a treat. Today he's making us a fall dessert, a soup recipe using sunchokes, and then a one-pot dinner all on today's menu. Seed Savers do important work preserving heirloom varieties from generations ago. Harvest Public Media has that story. We meet two farmers later in the show who started raising animals after they retired. And a couple folks from the Bloomington Community Orchard come in to talk about planting fruit trees now that fall has set in. News stories from around the food world with Lou Ann Johnson.
We start with a story from the recent People's Climate March. An estimated 310,000 people marched in downtown New York last weekend, the largest ever public show of force from people demanding that the U.S. and other governments take stronger action against emissions that raise global temperatures. Floats, giant puppets, drummers, and marching bands joined the ranks as protesters marched the two-mile route. Author and environmental activist Bill McKibben said warming temperatures, droughts, and shifting rainfall already threaten food security in vulnerable areas such as Africa. Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland and the United Nations Special Envoy for Climate Change, said she began to hear from farmers in Africa more than 10 years ago that conditions were worsening. She said they no longer know when rainy seasons will come. There are longer periods of drought and then flooding. Donald Brown, a scholar in residence at Widener University's School of Law, said, quote, "It's a moral monstrosity not to consider our impacts on food in other parts of the world," unquote. Our blogger, Chad Bouchard, was at the march on Sunday, and he posted some photos at eartheats.org. A new study following nearly 50,000 people living in different regions of China finds that eating more fruit can reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. Although it's not new in Western studies, this has been the first study showing promise specifically in China, where stroke is a more common form of cardiovascular disease than ischemic heart disease, which is more common in the West. Oxford University researchers studied Chinese citizens with no history of cardiovascular disease from 10 different regions, half rural, half urban, for 7 years. Throughout that time, the participants rated their consumption of fruit on a scale of never to daily. Of those, 18% consumed fruit daily, 1.5 servings on average. Compared to those who never ate fruit, those who ate fruit daily reduced their risk by 25 to 40% and reduced their blood pressure. And when a group of 16 big food companies pledged to cut their overall calories by 1.5 trillion by 2015, scholars were skeptical. But the Healthy Weight Commitment Foundation has already overshot that target, with 6.4 trillion fewer calories sold in 2012 compared to 2007. An independent study released last week in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine analyzed data from 61,000 households and found that the amount of calories from those companies that people purchased in 2012, particularly families with children, had significantly declined over the five-year period. The largest drop came from high-calorie packaged foods. The report also found that the number of calories those 16 companies sold hit a plateau from 2011 to 2012, indicating that companies might have already made the biggest and easiest changes. The reductions did not correlate with large drops in obesity rates for children, which have remained level with only slight declines in recent years. Barbara Rolls, the past president of the Obesity Society and professor of nutrition at Pennsylvania State University, said the study doesn't reveal underlying causes of calorie reduction, which could include raising prices on rich foods or selling off parts of their company that manufacture unhealthy snacks. She called the study encouraging, but said more research is needed. The report's authors agreed and recommended a closer look into how the company's calorie reductions could be maintained or expanded. Find these complete articles on our website, eartheats.org, and get on Twitter to read stories we post every single day. Follow us at Earth Eats.
News in the books for another week. Thanks to Lou Ann Johnson.
See you next week.
Most vegetable seeds today are bred by seed companies to be hardy and easy to grow. They're created by crossbreeding different varieties and selecting for specific characteristics. Heirloom seeds are different. Like your grandmother's engagement ring, heirloom seeds have been passed down through generations. And today's gardeners likely wouldn't have access to many of their favorite heirloom plants if it weren't for the work of the Seed Savers Exchange. Harvest Public Media's Sarah Bowden has the story.
Steve Carlson shows me around the grounds of the Seed Savers Exchange Heritage Farm in Decorah, Iowa. Every year, a fraction of the nonprofit's 20,000 heirloom varieties preserved in a state-of-the-art refrigerated vault are grown out to replenish the seed stock.
We have gardens all over the place, just little gardens. It's not 890 acres of just plowed land. This is like 890 acres of kind of rugged limestone bluffs and forests and valleys and pasture land, and then these gardens are sprinkled in all over the place.
The limestone bluffs provide natural barriers between gardens. That way, rows of dragon carrots, trail of tear beans, and silver queen okra don't cross-pollinate. Seed Savers helped shape the heirloom community decades before these varieties became bistro delicacies.
We have like 6,000 heirloom tomatoes in our collection, so it's very likely that we have tomatoes in our collection that no one else does.
Before World War II, most produce grown and sold in the U.S. were heirlooms. Today, the majority of seeds are hybrids. Hybrids have a longer shelf life, but many of these strains can fall short in taste, texture, and appearance. Additionally, heirloom aficionados enjoy a connection to the past. As I munch on some Swiss chard, Carlson explains.
They are seeds with history, with stories, and they are related to specific recipes even.
It was a connection to the past that inspired Seed Savers founders Diane Ott Wheely and her former husband Kent Wheely. Diane and Kent weren't at Seed Savers the day I visited, but Carlson gave me a history of the company. As a wedding gift, the pair received seeds of German pink tomatoes and morning glory from Diane's grandfather. His parents carried the seeds with them when immigrating from Bavaria to Iowa.
Shortly after Diane got these seeds from her grandfather, he'd passed away, and so Diane and Kent felt this responsibility to ensure that these seed varieties that had been passed down in her family for multiple generations survived.
In 1975, the Wheelies started Seed Savers, trading seeds with about 30 gardeners. They believe the best way to preserve a plant variety is to grow it. Now heirlooms are back in style. Jay Miller, an editor at Better Homes and Gardens magazine, credits the foodie movement with heirlooms' growing popularity.
They've suddenly become novelties again, and I think they're considered to be gourmet, too. You find heirloom vegetables on a lot of restaurant menus that serve really high-end food.
Today, the Seed Savers Exchange has 13,000 members, reaching all 50 states and about two dozen countries. Some of the world's rarest fruits and vegetables bloom in Iowa. One Seed Savers member, Jerry Gettle of Mansfield, Missouri, joined in the 1990s.
I started trading seeds with people in Australia and Iraq, and from there, that really is what, you know, greatly influenced my interest.
In 98, Gettle started his own business, the Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. He says his business continues to grow. In fact, the recent recession was a lucrative period for Baker Creek. Many people returned to gardening to save on groceries and supplement their income.
The whole industry, you know, from Seed Savers to us to many of the other, you know, seed houses and even the people that don't sell heirlooms traditionally, all of a sudden they were scrambling to get enough seed of heirloom varieties just to keep them on their shelves.
Today, dozens of vendors sell heirlooms and millions of people eat them. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sarah Bowden.
Harvest Public Media brings us stories about farming and food. They're a reporting collaboration based in the Midwest. They also just published a 6-part series of reports about food waste called Tossed Out. They take us inside a landfill and then inside a family's refrigerator. Videos and audio stories and print stories. It's absolutely worth a visit to harvestpublicmedia.org. Apples, apple cider, brown sugar, spiced rum. Let's do this.
And what do you think it's going to be?
Something sweet and delicious.
Yeah. This is going to be a granite or a granita. And that means a frozen ice, like an Italian ice, a shaved ice. Basically, granita comes from granite, the stone granite that kind of, when you smash it, it kind of shaves off into little flakes. And so that's why the Italians call it a granita and the French call it a granite. And we're going to make that very easily. We've got a pot here, and then I've got all these ingredients, and you can see that they're all labeled very precisely. That means the pastry chef has probably been involved, because cooks are not that precise. So we've got 3 cups of apple cider. You know, the pastry being so much more kind of chemical, and you've got to follow recipes, and cooks do everything by taste, so it's a little bit different. All right, so I've got the 3 cups cider. Use your best local cider that you can find. I've got 1 cup of packed brown sugar. We've got 1/2 teaspoon of sweet seasons, which is one of my spice blends, as well as 1/2 teaspoon of allspice. These are basically kind of the same flavors you're going to find in a malt cider. We've got 1/2 teaspoon of cloves, and then I've got 2 cinnamon sticks. And what we're going to do is we're going to bring this to a boil and let that sugar dissolve, and we'll be right back after that.
Chef Daniel Orr working on a delicious apple dessert for us. The rest of this recipe in the second half of the show. The Bloomington Community Orchard is chock full of pear, plum, apple, and peach trees. It's also brimming with good energy. To the volunteers who work in the orchard, this place is more than just a collection of trees. It's a community commons. Michael Simmons and Amy Roche came into the Earth Eats studios last year around this time as they were preparing the trees for winter. Simmons assures potential orchardists that it doesn't take an advanced degree in gardening to maintain a fruit tree.
Trees are not difficult to care for. Fruit trees are perhaps more difficult than other kinds of trees that we plant. But the secret is in soil preparation and proper planting, and then in providing the adequate amounts of water, particularly during the first 3 years of life for the tree. I think probably the most trees that die because of lack of proper water during their first 3 years.
When I speak with people who raise pigs or cattle in, you know, grass-fed organic way, they think, you know, I'm not so much raising these animals, I'm growing grass. I'm becoming better and better at growing food for the animals. Do you guys think about that in terms of the soil?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is particularly true with fruit trees, which are dependent in large part on some very complex relationships with the soil food web to uptake their nutrition that they need. Fortunately, adding compost to soil is something that can increase the water-holding capacity of the soil and at the same time increase the permeability of the soil so that water will drain more readily. So it's doubly beneficial. In addition, it adds microbes to the soil food web and provides organic matter for the plants as well. So
it's everything.
Everything, yes. Adding compost is essential. However, when planting the tree, it's very important that people not fertilize the tree when they plant it. That's probably the second greatest cause of death in fruit trees, is putting fertilizer into the planting hole. So really all that's necessary is a little bit of compost and then putting the soil that came out of the hole back into the hole.
That native soil.
The native soil.
If you put fertilizer right in there, then the roots may never go beyond that.
Does it seem weird that we're talking about planting new crops as the weather is turning cold and the days are getting shorter? Well, no, not at all, actually. Trees can be planted when they're dormant. So planting especially apple trees, for instance, in November is not uncommon at all.
Fall planting of many fruit trees is very good in our area. It gives them a little bit of a head start on the growth cycle. They get to establish their roots a little bit through the winter time.
But then you have to give them a hand to make sure they get through the winter unscathed. Trunk protectors to prevent gnawing mammals like voles from getting at the trees. Those plastic covers have the added benefit of preventing southwest injury,
which is caused by unequal heating of bark during cold weather. So the southwestern side gets hot faster and expands more. So it equalizes the expansion of the bark around the tree.
So it doesn't split. And then exactly. Become susceptible to disease, just as we would with a wound in our skin, you know. Mm-hmm. Make sure that mulch is pulled back away from the trunks of trees to give some space so that, again, as vole prevention, because if that's open, voles are less likely to make that leap from burrowing under mulch over to the trunk because they could be viewed by a hawk or something like that.
which we have plenty.
Yeah,
we do, and we have we have hawks that seem to really like the orchard.
And I've seen some of those bulls, and darn, they're really cute. I'm like, oh, I want you to go away, but I kind of want you to stay.
This has been a pleasure. Thanks
Thank
for coming.
Thank you.
In.
All
right.
Amy Roche and Michael Simmons of the Bloomington Community Orchard. If you've now felt the urge to add some fruit trees to your land, see their tips at eartheats.org. While we're talking about apple trees, and Chef Daniel Orr has some apples out in the kitchen already, here's another quick recipe that tastes like fall. The primary ingredient here is sunchokes. Maybe you've seen them in the produce section.
A lot of people know them as Jerusalem artichokes. But they don't come from Jerusalem, and they're nothing like artichokes.
Oh, excellent.
So I don't know how they got that name. But as you can see, it's a tuber, it's a root, and they grow everywhere from the South clear up through Michigan. And they have a really kind of neat, nutty flavor. They're crunchy. You can eat them raw if you want to have a little taste.
Let's try this. Ooh, delicious.
A little bit fruity. Has a touch of sweetness to it. And what we're going to do today is we're going to make a soup out of them, which is a really nice way to give an introduction to sunchokes to your friends and family. So basically what we're going to do is we're going to start, as we often do, with a little bit of olive oil and some garlic, because we love our garlic here at Earth Eats. And to the toasted garlic, we're going to add some chopped onions. We're going to put the potatoes in next, the apples to give it that sweetness, and we're going to add some heavy cream, a little bit of nutmeg, and about 3 tablespoons of butter. So again, we're going to cook this until the cream has mostly evaporated and the potatoes and sunchokes are soft, and then we'll puree it and taste it.
It's simple, very subtle. A fun new recipe to try is at eartheats.org. Coming up, when Jerry Perrin was trying to figure out which animals to raise on his new farm, he picked a small breed of pigs called the American Guinea Hog for one very simple reason.
We just can't imagine dealing with 800 pounds of hog. We're in our 70s, and you don't mess with an 800-pound hog.
Those pigs are also very friendly, and they're prized by area chefs. More coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hey, this is Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Looks like we're ready to finish off our apple-spiced granite. Last we heard from Chef Daniel Orr, he was waiting for some sugar to dissolve in the apple cider.
Pouring that through a strainer to get the cinnamon sticks out and the cloves. And now we're going to add a couple more ingredients. We have 2 ounces of spiced rum, a dark rum, and we have 1 tablespoon of real vanilla extract. Okay, we're going to stir this in. All right, now we're going to put that in the freezer, and we're going to let that freeze for a minimum of 3 to 4 hours, or even better, overnight. And it's great if you have time to get in there with a fork every once in a while, once it starts to freeze, and just kind of rake it around and start building those kind of Italian ice crystals. Yeah, we have some ready. Now I'm just going to shave it into those ice crystals. And if it seems, if sometimes, depending on what kind of cider, how sweet it is, it may be a little bit syrupy or not get real crunchy. If that happens to you, just add a little bit of water to it and throw it back in the freezer, and that will allow you to get those ice crystals going. Okay, and to serve this, you could serve it over, you know, fruit compote if you'd like, or you could even layer it in a glass with some vanilla ice cream would be good. But we're just going to serve it fresh with some apple slices. And I've got a frozen glass bowl and ice in the middle standing up. And then I can garnish it with a little mint out of the garden. And there you go. Very simple make-ahead dessert, spiced apple cider granite.
This was a great one. If you make it, we want to know how it turns out. Send us an email to eartheats@gmail.com. Farmers are getting older. That's according to some recent census data. While Jerry and Paula Perrin, who are both in their 70s, might fit into that typical demographic for farmers, what sets them apart is that they're relatively new to the game. EarthEats Mark Chilla has this profile of their J&P Heritage Farm.
At Jerry and Paula Perrin's farm in Spencer, Indiana, they have amassed a menagerie of animals, including turkeys, guinea fowl, and some fin sheep. Those, though, they're raising just for the fleece.
We would have a hard time butchering them because they're so darling.
The minute we come out the door, the lambs will start moving towards us, calling us.
Meh, meh.
However, their pride and joy are their American guinea hogs. They raise these hogs for meat, yes, but there are also a number of mainstays on the farm used only for breeding. These hogs get names.
So we have Fred and Ethel and Emma.
American guinea hogs are a rare breed, different from your average commercial hog. And as Jerry and Paula have found out, these hogs are special, and not just because of their prized meat.
These guys are just very friendly. They know their names. I can call Emma, and Ethel and Fred will stay, and Emma will come.
Well, our biggest hog right now is Fred. He's our principal boar. He's the mating giant. Fred is maybe 300 pounds, but he probably won't get any bigger than
maybe
that.
Maybe 400. He is huge. He's a big boy.
Big is a relative term, though. Compared to what you'd see on your average commercial farm, American guinea hogs are actually fairly small.
They never get huge like the, I call them industrial hogs, right? You'll never see a guinea hog get to 600 to 800 pounds.
But Jerry and Paula prefer these smaller hogs, and there's a reason for that.
We just can't imagine dealing with 800 pounds of hog. We're in our 70s, and you know, you don't mess with an 800-pound hog.
Jerry and Paula, you see, are retired. Farming is something that they only took up after retirement. For most of their life, they lived in Denver, where they worked in education.
Because we love kids, we decided, well, we'll just take up animals. And we just love them, but you have to also support yourself.
What started out as more or less a hobby in retirement has grown into this small, sustainable business. They wanted to gain something more out of their farm, and that's when they became involved in the farm-to-table movement. They brought their hogs first to the attention of our very own Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington.
One day, about a year ago, we stopped in here for lunch, and I asked to talk to Chef Daniel, and when I mentioned American guinea hog, he said, when you have one that's ready for processing, call me.
It took over a year for that hog to get to the right size, which is pretty slow, but that's all part of the American guinea hog's appeal.
They mature much more slowly than the production hogs, and the end result is that they're worth the wait because their meat is red, not white. And it's just surpassingly wonderful.
J&P Heritage Farm is part of what you might call the slow food movement, using high-quality feed to produce high-quality local meat.
These guys are getting very good food. And I think that's why the flavor of the meat is more mellow, a little richer.
But raising hogs means growing that food, and they've learned quickly that it requires an extensive knowledge of what grows well on the land. the farm has been an ongoing learning experience.
Just makes me spend a lot of time thinking about how to improve the pasture, grow better grass, more nourishing grass, so that means more legumes.
J&P Heritage Farm only began to make a profit after about 3 years. As retirees, Jerry and Paula are not really interested in achieving that huge profit margin. They instead prefer to keep their operation, like their hogs, small. For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
Jerry and Paula Perrin run J&P Heritage Farm. We have more profiles of farmers on our website, and that is eartheats.org. Here's a recipe that's really straightforward and cuts down on cleanup time because it's just one pot and a bamboo steamer, which is a series of cooking trays with latticed bottoms to allow steam from a boiling pot to cook food in the top of the tray. Chef Daniel Orr has his all set up.
Okay, so you can see what that looks like here on the stove set up. What we're going to do is start by seasoning our chicken, and I'm going to just cut some little slits, kind of like scales, down the chicken breast, leaving little pockets. I'm going to rub about a teaspoon of garlic on each one, and then I'm going to grab a nice handful of fresh herbs, basil, thyme, parsley, scallions. And what you do is you tuck a little bit of that into each one of those slits. What this is going to do, it's going to allow your chicken to cook more quickly, and also it's going to flavor even the thickest part of the bird. So then what we're going to do is put our chicken in the steamer, just kind of tuck it along the side. Okay, and then you can take all of your favorite vegetables. And again, you want everything to cook at the same rate, so you want to cut everything fairly thinly. So you've got this really beautiful box, and we're just going to take it over to the stove, right on the steamer. We're going to cover that up, and we're going to leave that on high. Make sure you have enough water in there so it doesn't burn up on you. And we're going to let that steam for about 10 minutes.
Ready?
Thank you, dear.
You're welcome.
Are you ready for the reveal?
Voila! All right, you can see that steam coming off of there. And we're going to just season it with the veggies with a little salt and pepper and just a sprinkle of lemon juice. So this is very, very healthy, very clean. We've got here on the side some sauces. The Asian one is a good one to start with. A little plum sauce, a little sesame oil, a little chili paste. All right, and that's it. That's a wonderful weekday dinner for the healthiest family in town.
We would love other recipe ideas for our bamboo steamer. If you've got a tried and true recipe that your family loves, tweet it at us. We're at Earth Eats. Our crew includes Avon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and all the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. That's Earth Eats for the week. See you in October. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.